fingers. "Sounds like jazz," he said. The orange streetlight from the window latticed him as he crossed the floor at a clip. Hours and hours of insanity and escape. The projects were a victim of theft and wind. The downdrafts made their own weather. Plastic bags caught on the gusts of summer wind. Old domino players sat in the courtyard, playing underneath the flying litter. The sound of the plastic bags was like rifle fire. If you watched the rubbish for a while, you could tell the exact shape of the wind. Perhaps in a way it was alluring, like little else around it. Whole, bright, slapping curlicues and large figure eights, helixes and whorls and corkscrews. Sometimes a bit of plastic caught against a pipe or touched the top of the chain-link fence and backed away gracelessly, like it had been warned. The handles came together and the bag collapsed. There were no tree branches to be caught on. One boy from a neighbouring flat stuck a lineless fishing pole out the window, but he didn't catch any. The bags often stayed up in one place, as if they were contemplating the whole grey scene, and then they would take a sudden dip, a polite curtsy, and away. I'd fooled myself into thinking I'd some poems in me while I was in Dublin. It was like hanging old clothes out to dry. Everyone in Dublin was a poet. Maybe even the bombers who treated us to their afternoon of delight. I'd been in the South Bronx a week. It was so humid some nights we had to shoulder the door closed. Kids on the 10th floor aimed television sets at the housing cops who patrolled below. Airmail. The police came in, clubbing. Shots rang out from the rooftop. On the radio there was a song about the revolution being ghettoised. Arson on the streets. It was a city with its fingers in the garbage, a city that ate off dirty dishes. I had to get out. The plan was to look for a job, get my own little place, maybe work on a play, or get a job on a paper somewhere. There were ads in the circulars for bartenders and waiters, but I didn't want to go that way, all flat hats and mixing shirt sleeves. I found a gig as a telemarketer, but I needed a dedicated phone line in Corrigan's apartment, and it was impossible to get a technician to visit the housing complex. This was not the America I had expected. Corrigan wrote out a list of things for me to see. Cholmondeley's Bar in the village, the Brooklyn Bridge, Central Park by day. But I had little money to speak of. I went to the window and watched the plot of the days unfold. The rubbish accused me. Already the smell rose up to the fifth-floor windows. Corrigan worked as part of his order's ethic, made a few bob by driving a van for some old folk in the local nursing home. The bumper was tied with rusted wire. The windows were plastered with his peace stickers. The front headlights hung loose in the grill. He was gone most of the day, in charge of the ones that were infirm. What was ordeal for others was grace for him. He picked them up in the late morning in the nursing home on Cypress Avenue. Mostly Irish, Italian, one old Jewish man nicknamed Albie, in a grey suit and skullcap. "Short for Albert," he said. "But if you call me Albert, I'll kick your ass." I sat in with them a few afternoons, men and women, most of them white, who could have been folded up just like their wheelchairs. Corrigan drove at a snail's pace, so as not to bounce them around. "You drive like a pussy," said Albie from the back seat. Corrigan laid his head against the steering wheel and laughed, but kept his foot on the brake. Cars behind us beeped, a hellish ruckus of horns. The air was stifled with ruin. "Move it, man, move it," Albie shouted. "Move the goddamn van." Corrigan took his foot off the brake and slowly guided the van around to the playground at St. Mary's, where he wheeled the old folk out into whatever bits of shade he could find. "Fresh air," he said. The men sat rooted like Larkin poems. The old women looked shaken, heads nodding in the breeze, watching the playground. It was mostly black or Hispanic kids, zooming down the slides or swinging on the monkey bars. Albie managed to wheel himself into the corner, where he took out sheets of paper. He bent over them and said not another word, scratching on the paper with a pencil. I hunkered down beside him. "What you doing there, friend?"
"None of your goddamn business."
"Chess, is it?"
"You play?" he asked.
"Right on."
"You rated?"
"Rated?"
"Oh, get the fuck out of here. You're a pussy too."
Corrigan winked at me from the edge of the playground. This was his world, and he plainly loved it. Lunch had been made for them in the old folks' home, but Corrigan went across the road to the local bodega to buy them extra potato crisps, cigarettes, a cold beer for Albie. A yellow awning. A bubblegum machine sat triple chained to the shutters. A dustbin was overturned at the corner. There had been a garbage strike earlier that spring, and still it wasn't all cleaned up. Rats ran along the street gutters. Young men in sleeveless tops stood malevolently in the doorways. They knew Corrigan, it seemed, and as he disappeared inside, he gave them a series of elaborate handshakes. He spent a long time inside and came out clutching large brown paper bags. One of the hoodlums backslapped him, grabbed his hand, drew him close.
"How do you do that?" I asked. "How do you get them to talk to you?
Why wouldn't they?
It just seems, I don't know, they're tough, you know."
"Far as they're concerned, I'm just a square."
"You're not worried? You know, a gun or something, a switchblade?"
"Why would I be?"
Together we loaded the old folk up in the van. He read the engine and drove to the church. There had been a vote among the old folk, the church as opposed to the synagogue. It was daubed in graffiti, whites, yellows, reds, silvers, tags 173, Graco 76. The stained glass windows had been broken with small stones, even the cross on top was tagged.
"The living temple," said Corrigan.
The elderly Jewish man refused to get out. He sat, head down, saying nothing, skipping through the notes in his book. Corrigan opened the back of the van and slipped him an extra beer over the seat.
"He's all right, our Albie," said Corrigan as he strolled away from the back of the van. "All he does is work on those chess problems all day long. Used to be a grand master or something. Came from Hungary, found himself in the Bronx. He sends his games off in the post somewhere. Does about 20 games all at once. He can play blindfolded. It's the only thing that keeps him going." He helped the others out of the van, and we wheeled them one by one towards the entrance.
"Let's walk the plank," Corrigan said.
There were a series of broken steps at the front, but Corrigan had stashed two long pieces of wood around the side near the sacristy. He laid the planks parallel to each other and guided the chairs up. The wood lifted in the air with the weight of the wheelchairs, and for a moment they looked like they were bound for the sky. Corrigan pushed them forward, and the planks slapped back down. He had the look of a man at ease, a shine in the corners of his eyes. You could see the gone boy in him, the 9-year-old back in Sandymount. He left the old folk waiting by the holy water font until they were all lined up, ready to go.
"My favourite moment of the day, this," he said. He crossed over into the cool dark of the church, rolled them to whatever spot they wanted, some in the rear pews, some to the sides. An old Irish woman was brought up to the very front, where she wrapped and rewrapped her rosary beads. She had a mane of white hair, blood in the corner of her eyes, an otherworldly stare.
"Meet Sheila," said Corrigan.
She could hardly speak any more, barely able to make a sound. A cabaret singer, she had lost most of her voice to throat cancer. She had been born in Galway, but emigrated just after the First World War. She was Corrigan's favourite, and he stayed near her, said the formal prayers alongside her, a decade of the rosary. She had no idea, I'm sure, about his religious ties, but there was an energy about her in that church she didn't have elsewhere. She and Corrigan, it was like they were praying together for a good rain. When we got out into the street again, Albie was dozing in the van, a bit of spittle on his chin. "God damn it," he muttered when the engine rumbled into life. "Pair of pussies, the two of you." Corrigan pulled into the nursing home in the late afternoon, then dropped me off in front of the housing project. He had another job to do, he said. There was someone he had to see. "It's a little project I'm working on," he said over his shoulder. "Nothing to worry about. I'll see you later." He climbed in and touched something in the glove box of his van before he took off. "Don't wait up for me," he called. I watched him go, hand out the window, waving. He was holding something back, I knew. It was pitch black when I saw him finally arriving back down among the whores alongside the Major Deegan. He gave out iced coffee from a giant silver canister that he kept in the back of the van. The girls gathered around him as he spooned ice into their cups. Jaslyn wore a one-piece neon swimsuit. She tugged the back, snapped the elastic, edged close to him, gave the hint of a belly dance against his hip. She was tall, exotic, so very young she seemed to flutter. Playfully she pushed him backwards. Corrigan ran a circle around her, high-stepping. A scream of laughter. She ran off when she heard a car horn blow. Around Corrigan's feet lay a row of empty paper coffee cups. Later he came back upstairs, thin, dark-eyed, exhausted. "How was your meeting?"
"Oh, grand, yeah," he said. "No problem." "Out tripping the light fantastic?"
"Ah, yeah, the Copacabana, you know me."
He collapsed on the bed, but was up early in the morning to a quick mug of tea. No food in the house, just tea and sugar and milk. He said his prayers and then touched the crucifix as he went towards the door once more.
"Down to the girls again?"
He looked at his feet.
"I suppose so."
"You really think they need you, Cor?"
"Don't know," he said. "I hope so."
The door swung on its hinges. I've never been interested in calling out the moral brigade. Not my place, not my job. Each to his own. You get what you create. Corrigan had his reasons. But these women disturbed me. They were light years removed from anything I'd ever known. The high of their eyes, their heroine sway, their swimsuits. Some of them had needle marks at the backs of their knees. They were more than foreign to me. Down in the courtyard, I walked the long way around the projects, following the broken lines in the concrete, just to avoid them. A few days later, a gentle knock sounded on the door. An older man with a single suitcase. Another monk from the order. Corrigan rushed to embrace him. "Brother Norbert!" He had come from Switzerland. Norbert's sad brown eyes gladdened me. He looked around the apartment, swallowed deeply, said something about the Lord Jesus and a place of deep shelter. On his second day, Norbert was robbed in the lift at gunpoint. He said he had gladly given them everything, even his passport. There was a shine like pride in his eyes. The Swiss man sat in serious prayer for 2 solid days, not leaving the apartment. Corrigan stayed down on the streets most of the time. Norbert was too formal and correct for him. "It's like he's got a toothache and he wants God to cure it," said Corrigan. Norbert refused the couch, lay on the floor. He balked each time the door opened and the hookers came in. Jaslyn sat in his lap, ran her fingers on the rim of his ear, messed with his orthopedic shoes, hid them behind the couch. She told him that she could be his princess. He blushed until he almost wept. Later, when she was gone, his prayers became high-pitched and frantic.
The beloved life was spared, but not the pain. The beloved life was spared, but not the pain. He broke down in tears. Corrigan was able to get Norbert's passport back, and he drove him out to the airport in the brown van to get a flight to Geneva. Together they prayed, and then Corrigan dispatched him. He looked at me as if he expected me to be leaving also. "I don't know who these people are," he said. "They're my brothers, but I don't really know who they are. I failed them." "You should leave this hole, Cor." "Why would I leave? My life's here. Find somewhere with a bit of sunshine, you and me together. I've been thinking about California or somewhere like that." "I'm called here." "You could be called anywhere. This is where I am." I said, "How did you get his passport back?" "Oh, I just dashed around." "He was robbed at gunpoint, Cor." "I know." "You're going to get hurt." "Oh, give me a break." I went to the chair by the window and watched the large tractor trailer is pulling up under the highway. The girls jostled to get at them. A single neon sign blinked in the distance, an advertisement for oatmeal. "The edge of the world here," said Corrigan. "You could do something back home, in Ireland, up north, Belfast. Something for us, your own people." "I could, yeah. Or shake up some campesinos in Brazil or something." "Yeah." "So why stay here?" He smiled. Something had gone wild in his eyes. I couldn't tell what it was. He put his hands up close to the ceiling fan, as if he were about to thrust them in there, right up into the whirling blades, leave his hands there, watch them get mangled. In the raw of mornings, the girls stretched in a line along the block, though daylight thinned them out. After his morning matins, Corrigan went down to the corner deli to buy the Catholic Worker. Through the underpass, across the road, under the awning. Old men in their undershirts sat at the door, pigeons working breadcrumbs at their feet. Corrigan came out carrying the paper tucked under his arm. I could see him as he crossed back, framed through the concrete eye of the underpass. Out of the shadows, he passed the hookers, and they called to him in their sing-song. It hit the scale on about three different notes. "Corrigan! Corrigan! Corrigan!" He passed through the gauntlet. Jaslyn stood chatting with him, her thumb hooked under the strap of her swimsuit. She looked like an old-time cop in the wrong body, snapping the thin, lime-coloured straps against her breasts. She leaned close to him again, her bare skin almost touching his lapel. He didn't recoil. She was getting a charge from it all, I could tell. The lean of her young body, the hard snap of the strap, her nipple against the fabric, her head tilting closer and closer to him. As cars passed, she turned to watch them, and her morning shadow lengthened. It was like she wanted to be everywhere, all at once. She leaned closer still and whispered in my brother's ear. He nodded, turned, and went back towards the deli, came out carrying a can of Coke. Jaslyn clapped her hands in delight, took it from him, pulled the ring off, sauntered away. A row of 18-wheelers was parked along the expressway. She propped her leg on the silver grill and sipped from the can, then suddenly threw the drink on the ground and climbed up into the truck. Halfway in the door, she was already removing her swimsuit. Corrigan turned away. The cola lay in a black puddle in the gutter beneath her. It happened times in a row. Jaslyn asking him for a can of Coke, then throwing it to the ground when she found a mark. I thought I should go down to her, negotiate a price and treat myself to whatever trick it was she was able for. Grab the back of her hair, bring her face close to mine, that sweet breath, curse her, spit on her, for wringing out my brother's charity. "Hey, leave the door open for them, will you?" he said to me after he came home.
I had taken to closing the locks in the afternoon, even though they pounded on the door.
Why don't they piss in their own houses, Corrigan?
Because they don't have houses. They have apartments.
Why don't they piss in their own apartments, then?
Because they've got families. Mothers and fathers and brothers and sons and daughters. They don't want their families to see them dressed like that.
They've got kids?
Sure. Jazz, she got kids.
Two, he said.
Oh, man.
Tilly's her mother.
I turned on him. I knew how it sounded. Step into that river, you don't step out, no return. It came out in a torrent, how disgusting they were, sucking on his blood, all of them, leaving him thin, dry, helpless, taking the life out of him. Leeches, worse than leeches, bedbugs that crawled from the wallpaper. He was a fool. All his religiosity, all his pious horseshit, it came down to nothing. The world is vicious, and that's what it amounts to, and hope is nothing more or less than what you can see with your own bare eyes. He pulled at a small thread on the sleeve of his shirt, but I caught his elbow. Don't give me your shit about the Lord upholding all that fall and raising up all that be bowed down. The Lord's too big to fit in their miniskirts. Guess what, brother? Look at them. Look out the window. No amount of sympathy is ever going to change it. Why don't you cop on? You're just placating your conscience, that's all. God comes along and sanctifies your guilt. His lips broke open a little. I waited, but still he did not speak. We were so close together I could see his tongue move behind his teeth, flicking up and down like something nervous. His eyes were fixed and intent. Grow up, brother. Pack your bags, go somewhere you matter. They deserve nothing. They're not Magdalens. You're just a bum among them. You're looking for the poor man within. Why don't you humble yourself at the feet of the rich for once? Or does your God just love useless people? I could see the small, oblong reflection of the white door in his pupils, and I kept thinking that one of his hookers, one of his holy failures, was going to walk in, and I'd see her reflection in the flicker. Why don't you embarrass the rich with some of your charity? Go sit on a rich woman's step and bring her to God. Tell me this, if the poor really are the living image of Jesus, why are they so fucking miserable? Tell me that, Corrigan. Why are they standing out there displaying their misery to the rest of the world? I want to know. It's just vanity, isn't it? Love thy neighbour as thyself. It's rubbish. You listening? Why don't you take all those hookers of yours and have them go sing in the choir? The Church of the High Vision. Why don't you have them sit in the front pews? I mean, there you go on your knees to all the tramps and the lepers and the cripples and dopeheads. Why don't they do something? Because they want nothing but to suck you dry, that's why. Exhausted, I laid my head against the windowsill. I kept waiting for him to give me some sort of bitter benediction, something about being weak towards the strengthless, strong against the powerful. There is no peace save in Jesus. Freedom is given, not received. Some catch-all to soothe me. But instead, he let it all wash over him. His face didn't betray a thing. He scratched the inside of his arm and nodded. Just leave the door open, he said. He went down the stairwell, footsteps echoing, around the edge of the courtyard, disappeared into the greyness. I ran down the slick steps of the apartment building, huge swirls of fat graffiti on the walls, the drift of hash smoke, broken glass on the bottom steps, smells of piss and puke. Through the courtyard, a man held a pit bull on a training rope. He was teaching it to bite. The dog snapped at his arm. There were huge metal bracelets strapped across the man's wrists. The snarls rolled across the yard. Corrigan was backing up his brown van, which he'd parked on the side of the road. I slapped the windows. He didn't turn. I suppose I thought I might knock some sense into him, but after a moment, the van was out of sight. Over my shoulder, the dog was snapping again at the man's arm, but the man was staring at me like I was the one trying to rip his wrists.
A half-smile crawled over his face, malevolent and pure. I thought, nigger. I couldn't help it, but that's what I thought, nigger. This place would ruin me. How did Corrigan stand it?
I wandered the neighbourhood, hands down deep in my pockets, not on the pavement, but at the edge of parked cars, an altered perspective. Taxis brushed by close to my hip. The wind blew the smell of the subways up through the traffic, a hard, musty waft. I went to the church on St. Anne's, up the broken steps, into the vestibule, past the holy water font, into the dark. I was half expecting to see him there, head bowed, praying, but no. Small red electric candles could be lit at the back of the church. I dropped a quarter inside and heard the deep rattle against the emptiness. My father's ancient voice in my ear, "If you don't want the truth, don't ask for it." Corrigan came home to the apartment late that night. I left the door unlocked, but he came in with a screwdriver anyway, began to take all the screws from the chains and locks. "Job to do," he said. He was lethargic, and his eyes were rolling around in his head, and I should have known then, but I didn't recognize it. He knelt on the floor, eye level with the doorknob. The underside of his sandals were worn down. The sole had faded away, a little bubble of flat rubber. His carpenter pants were tied around his waist with a length of cord. They wouldn't have stayed up on his hips otherwise. The long-sleeve shirt he wore was tight to his body, and the bones of his ribcage were like some odd musical instrument. He worked intently, but he was using a flathead screwdriver for a Phillips head bolt, and he had to prop the screwdriver sideways and angle it into the grooves. I had already packed my bag and was ready to go. Find a room, get a bartending job, anything, just get out of there. I pulled the couch into the centre of the room under the ceiling fan, folded my arms, waited. The blades couldn't cut through the heat. For the first time ever, I noticed that Corrigan had a bald spot beginning in the back of his hair. I wanted to make some crack about it being a monkish thing, but there was nothing between us anymore. No words or glances. He toiled away at the locks. A couple of screws fell on the floor. I watched the beads of sweat come down the back of his neck. He rolled up his sleeve absent-mindedly. And then I knew. If you think you know all the secrets, you think you know all the cures. I suppose it wasn't too much of a surprise to me that Corrigan was scoring heroin. He had always done what the least of them had done. It was the perverse mantra of what he believed. He wanted to hear his own footsteps to prove that he trod the ground. There was no getting away from it. It was what he had done in Dublin too, though a different quarry of recklessness. He was standing on the little ledge of reality he had left, but it seemed to me that he wasn't getting high, just getting level. He had an affinity with pain. If he couldn't cure it, he took it on. He was shooting smack because he couldn't stand the thought of others being left alone with the same terror. He left his sleeve rolled up for an hour or so while he dealt with the locks. The bruises inside his arm were a deep blue. When he was finished, the door didn't even click closed, just swung on the hinges. "There," he said. He went into the bathroom, where I was sure I could hear him strapping an elastic band around his arm. He came out, long-sleeved again. "Now leave the friggin' door alone," he said. He fell soundlessly into bed. I was sure I wouldn't sleep, but I woke to the usual thrum of the Deegan. The outside world was dependable, engine noise and tire song. Huge metal sheets had been laid over some potholes. They boomed deeply when a truck ran over them. It was an easy enough choice to stay. It wasn't as if Corrigan was ever going to ask me to leave. I was up and shaved early in the morning to accompany him on his rounds. I stirred him from the blankets. He had a faint nosebleed, and the blood was dark against his stubble. He turned away. "Put on the tea, will you?" When he stretched, he touched the wooden crucifix on the wall. It swung back and forth on its nail. There was a light patch where the paint wasn't discoloured, the faint imprint of the cross. He reached up to steady it, muttered something about God being ready to move sideways. "Leaving today?" he asked. The rucksack was packed on the floor. "I was thinking I'd stay a couple more days," I said.
"No problem, brother."
He combed his hair in the fragment of broken mirror, sprayed on some deodorant. At least he was keeping up pretenses. We took the lift instead of the stairs.
"A miracle," said Corrigan as the door sighed open and the little moons of light shone on the inside panel. "It's working."
Outside, we crossed the small patch of grass in front of the projects among the broken bottles. All of a sudden, being around him felt right for the first time in years. That old dream of purpose. I knew what I had to do. Bring him on the long walk back towards a sensible life. Among the early morning hookers, I felt strangely charmed.
"Corrigan! Corrigan! Corrigan!"
It was, after all, my last name, too. It was a strange taking of ease. Their bodies did not embarrass me as much as when I'd watched them from afar. Coyly, they covered their breasts with their arms. One had dyed her hair a bright red, another wore sparkling silver eyeliner. Jaslyn, in her neon swimsuit, positioned the strap over her nipples. She took a deep drag on her cigarette and exhaled smoke in expert streams from nose and mouth. Her skin shone. In another life she could have been aristocratic. Her eyes went to the ground as if she was looking to find something she had dropped. I felt a softening for her, a desire. They kept up a wavery pitch of banter. My brother gazed across at me and grinned. It was like Corrigan whispering in my ear to give his approval to all I couldn't understand. A few cars cruised past.
"Get out of here," said Tilly. "We got business to accomplish."
She said it like it was a stock exchange transaction. She nodded to Jaslyn. Corrigan pulled me into the shadows.
"They all use smack," I said.
"Some of them, yeah."
"Nasty stuff," I said.
"The world tries them, then shows them a little joy." I asked, "Who gets it for them, the smack?"
"No idea," he said as he took a small silver pocket watch out from his carpenter pants.
"Why?"
"Just wondering."
The cars rumbled above us. He slapped my shoulder. We drove to the nursing home. A young nurse was waiting on the steps. She stood up and waved brightly as the van pulled in. She looked South American, small and beautiful, with a clout of black hair and dark eyes. Something fierce shot in the air between them. He loosened around her, his body more pliable. He put his hand on the small of her back, and they both disappeared inside the electronic door. In the glove box of the van I looked for evidence, needles, packets, drug paraphernalia, anything. It was empty, except for a well-worn Bible. In the inside flap, Corrigan had written scattered notes to himself. "The wish to make desire null, to be idle in the face of nature, pursue them and beg for forgiveness. Resistance is at the heart of peace." When he was a boy, he had seldom even folded down the pages of his Bible. He had always kept it pristine. Now the days were stacked up against him. The writing was spidery, and he had underlined passages in deep black ink. I recalled the myth that I had once heard as a university student. 36 hidden saints in the world, all of them doing the work of humble men, carpenters, cobblers, shepherds. They bore the sorrows of the earth, and they had a line of communication with God. All except one,
the hidden saint, who was forgotten. The forgotten one was left to struggle on his own, with no line of communication to that which he so hugely needed. Corrigan had lost his line with God. He bore the sorrows on his own. The story of stories. I watched as the short nurse negotiated the ramp with the wheelchairs. She had a tattoo at the base of her ankle. It crossed my mind that she might be the one supplying him heroin, but she looked so cheerful in the hot, slanting sun. "Adelita," she said, extending her hand out to me through the van window. "Corrigan's told me all about you."
"Hey, get your carcass out here and help us," my brother said from the side of the van.
He was straining to get the old Galway woman through the door. The veins in his neck pulsed. Sheila was just a rag doll of a thing. I had a sudden recollection of our mother at the piano. Corrigan breathed heavily as he heaved her inside, arranged a series of straps around the woman's body. "We have to talk," I said to him.
"Yeah, whatever. Let's just get these people in the van."
He and the nurse glanced at each other across the rim of the seats. She had a little bead of sweat around the top of her lip, and she wiped it away with the short sleeve of her uniform. As we drove off, she leaned against the ramp and lit a cigarette. "The lovely Adelita," he said, as he turned the corner.
"That's not what I want to talk about."
"Well, it's all I want to talk about," he said. He flicked a look in the rearview mirror and said, "Right, Sheila." He did a fake drum roll on the steering wheel. He was back to his old sing-song self. I wondered if perhaps he had shot up while inside the nursing home. From what little I knew of addiction, anything at all could happen. But he was bright and cheery, and didn't have many of the hallmarks of heroin, or at least the ones I imagined. He drove with one arm out the window, the breeze blowing back his hair. I said, "You're a mystery, you are."
"Nothing mysterious at all, brother."
Albie piped up from the back seat.
"Pussy!"
"Shut up," said Corrigan with a grin, his accent tinged a little by the Bronx. All he cared about was the moment he was in, the absolute now. When we had fought as children, he used to stand and take the blows. Our fights had lasted as long as I punched him. It would be easy to thump him now, fling him back against the van door, rifle his pockets, take out the packets of poison that were ruining him.
"We should make a visit back, Cor."
"Yeah," he said absently. "I mean to Sandymount, just for a week or two."
"Isn't the house sold?"
"Yeah, but we could find somewhere to stay."
"The palm trees," he said, half smiling. "Strangest sight in Dublin. I try to tell people about them, but they just don't believe me."
I said, "Would you go back?"
"Sometime, maybe."
"I might bring some people with me," he said.
"Sure."
He flicked a look in the rearview mirror. I couldn't imagine that he wanted to bring the old woman back to Ireland, but I was ready to let Corrigan have whatever space he needed. At the park, he wheeled them into the shadows by the wall. It was a bright day, sunny and close. Albie took out his sheaf of papers, muttering the moves to himself as he worked on his chest problems. Every time he made a good move, he let the brake go on his wheelchair and rocked himself back and forth in joy. Sheila wore a wide-brimmed straw hat over her long white hair. Corrigan dabbed his handkerchief on her brow. She scratched out some sounds from her throat. She had that emigrant sadness. She would never go back to her old country. It was gone in more senses than one, but she was forever gazing homewards anyway. Some kids nearby had turned on a fire hydrant and were dancing in the spray. One of them had taken a kitchen tray and was using it as a surfboard. The water skimmed him along by the monkey bars, where he fell headlong, laughing, into the fence. Others clamoured to use the tray. Corrigan moved over to the fence and pressed his hands against the wire diamonds. Beyond him, farther, some basketball players, sweat-soaked, driving towards the netless basket. It seemed for a moment that Corrigan was right, that there was something here, something to be recognised and rescued, some joy. I wanted to tell him that I was beginning to understand it, or at least get an inkling, but he called out to me and said he was running across to the bodega. "Watch Sheila for a while, will you?" he said. "Her hat's tilted. Don't let her get sunburned." A gang of youths in bandanas and tight jeans hung out in front of the bodega. They lit one another's cigarettes importantly. They gave Corrigan the usual hand slaps, then disappeared inside with him. I knew it. I could feel it welling up in me. I jogged across, my heart thumping in my cheap linen shirt. I stepped past the litter piled up outside the shop, liquor bottles, torn wrappers. A row of goldfish bowls sat in the window, the thin orange bodies spinning in aimless circles. A bell sounded. Inside, Motown came over the stereo. A couple of kids, dripping wet from the fire hydrant, stood by the ice cream vault. The older ones in their red bandanas were down by the beer fridges. Corrigan was at the counter, a pint of milk in his hand. He looked up, not the least bit disturbed. "I thought you were watching Sheila." "Is that what you thought?" I expected some shove, a packet of heroin into his pocket, some clandestine transaction across the counter, another hand slap with the gang. But there was nothing. "Just put it on my tab," said Corrigan to the shop owner, and he tapped one of the fish bowls on the way out. The shop doorbell rang. "They sell smack there too?" I asked, as we crossed through the traffic to the park. "You and your smack," he said. "Are you sure, Cor?"
"Am I sure of what?"
"You tell me, brother. You're looking rough. One look in the mirror." "You're kidding me, right?" He reared back and laughed. "Me?" he said. "Shooting smack?" We reached the fence. "I wouldn't touch that stuff with a barge pole," he said. His hands tightened around the wire, the tip of his knuckles white. "With all respect to heaven, I like it here." He turned to look at the short row of wheelchairs set out along the fence. Something remained fresh about him, young even. When he was 16, Corrigan had written, in the inside of a cigarette packet, that all the proper gospel of the world could be written in the inside of a cigarette packet. It was that simple. You could do unto others what you'd have them do unto you. But at that time, he hadn't figured on other complications. "You ever had the feeling that there's a stray something or other inside you?" he said. "You don't know what it is, like a ball or a stone. Could be iron or cotton or grass or anything, but it's inside you. It's not a fire or a rage or anything, just a big ball, and there's no way to get at it." He cut himself short, looked away, tapped the left side of his chest. "Well, here it is, right here." We seldom know what we're hearing when we hear something for the first time, but one thing is certain. We hear it as we will never hear it again. We return to the moment to experience it, I suppose, but we can never really find it, only its memory, the faintest imprint of what it really was, what it meant. "You're having me on, right?"
"Wish I was," he said.
"Come on now.
You don't believe me?"
"Jaslyn?" I asked, floored. "You haven't fallen for that hooker, have you?" He laughed heartily, but it was a laugh that ran away. His eyes shot across the playground, and he ran his fingers along the fence. "No," he said. "No, not Jaslyn, no." Corrigan drove me through the South Bronx under the flamed-up sky. The sunset was the colour of muscle, pink and striated grey. Arson. The owners of the buildings, he said, were running insurance scams. whole streets of tenements and warehouses abandoned to smoulder. Gangs of kids hung out on the street corners. Traffic lights were stuck on permanent red. At fire hydrants there were huge puddles of stagnant water. A building on Willis had half collapsed into the street. A couple of wild dogs picked their way through the ruin. A burned neon sign stood upright. Fire trucks went by, and a couple of cop cars trailed each other for comfort. Every now and then, a figure emerged from the shadows, homeless men pushing shopping trolleys piled high with copper wire. They looked like men on a westward hoe, shoving their wagons across the nightlands of America.
Who are they?
They ransacked the building, pulled the guts of the walls out, and then they sell the copper wire, he said. They get a dime a pound or something. Corrigan pulled the van up outside a series of tenements that were abandoned but untouched by fire, yanked the gear shift on the steering column down into park. A haze hung over the street. You could hardly see the top of the street lamps. Warning tape had been fixed over the doorways, but the doors behind them had been kicked in. He drew his feet up onto the seat so that his sandals were nestled close to his crotch. He lit a cigarette and brought it right down to the dregs, threw the butt out the window. Thing is, I have a mild case of a thing called TTP or something, he said finally. I started getting these bruises all over, here and here. It's worse on my legs. They're splotchy. About a year or so ago, at first I didn't really think anything of it, honest. I had a bit of a fever, a few dizzy spells. And then I was in the nursing home in February, helping them move some furniture from the first floor to the third. Stuff too big to fit in the elevator. And it was hot as hell in there. They keep the heat turned up for all the old ones. You can't imagine how hot, especially in the stairwell there, where the pipes were. Like Dante had furnished the place. Rough work. So I took off my shirt, down to my string vest. You know how many years it's been since I'd been down to a string vest. And I was halfway up the stairs with a few lads, when one of them points to me, my arms and shoulders, and says that I must have been in some sort of fight. Truth is, I had been in a fight. The pimps were giving me a hard time for letting the girls use the bathroom. I'd been knocked around a little, had some stitches over my eye. One of them wore cowboy boots and roughed me up good. But I didn't give it a second thought until we got the furniture up on the third floor and Adelita was there, directing the traffic. Put this here, put that there. We heaved this big desk into a corner. And the lads were still giving me a hard time about being the only white bloke who still gets in fights in the neighbourhood, like I'm some throwback, like I'm some big Jack Doyle, you know. They're all joking. Come on, Corrigan, let's dance, man, let's rumble. They say they ought to bring me to Zaire, I'm such a fighter. They don't know I'm in the order. Nobody knows. Not then, anyway, they didn't. And Adelita came over and just pushed her finger down hard on one of the bruises, and she said something like, "You've got TTP. And I made some crack about DDT, and she said, "No, I think it could be TTP. It turns out she's studying at night. She wants to do medicine. She was a nurse in Guatemala in a couple of fancy hospitals. Always wanted to be a doctor. Even went to university and all. But the war kicked in, and she got all caught up in it. Lost her husband. So she nurses here. They won't take her credentials. She's got two kids. They've got American accents now. Anyway, she says something about low platelet counts and bleeding into the tissues, and that I've got to get it seen to. She surprised me, brother." Corrigan rolled down the window of the van and sprinkled some tobacco on a thin piece of paper, lit up. "So fair enough, I get it seen to. And she's bang on. I have this thing they don't know much about. It's idiopathic, you know. They don't know what causes it. But they say it's serious enough. You can get real sick from it. I mean, you gotta eventually get the treatment or you can die. And so I go home at night
and I call on God in the dark, and I say, thanks God for another thing to worry about. But the thing is, God's there this time, brother. He's there, in plain sight. It would be easier if he wasn't there. I could pretend I was searching for him. But no, he's there, the son of a gun. He's telling me all the logical things about being sick and getting over it and dealing with it and looking at the world in a new way, the way he does. The way he should talk to you, the body and soul, the sacrament of being alone, being furious with an aim, using it for the greater good. Opening yourself to the promise. But see, this logical God, I don't like him all that much. Even his voice. He's got this voice that I just can't, I don't know, I can't like. I can understand it, but I don't necessarily like it. He's out of my range. But that's no problem. Plenty of times I haven't liked him. It's good to be at a disturbance with God. Plenty of fine people have been in my place and worse. I figure being sick is old news anyway, and dying's even older than that. What's fatal is the big hollow echo every time I tried him out. See, I just felt hollow every time I tried talking with him. I gave it everything, brother. My proper confession, you know, about maintaining faith and all. I talked with Father Marek there in St. Anne's, a good priest. We struggled together, him and I, hours on end. And with him too, with God, at all hours of the day. Used to be, though, that the arguments with him stirred the depths of my heart. I wept in his presence. But he kept coming back at me with all his pure logic. Still, I knew it would pass. I knew I'd get over it. I wasn't even thinking about Adelita then. She wasn't even on my mind. It was losing God, the prospect of losing that. The rational part of me knew it was me. I mean, I was just talking to myself. I was obstructing him. But being rational about it didn't cure it. You meet a rational God and you say, well, okay, that's not my cup of tea right now, Heavenly Father. I'll come back at a better time. You know, when you're young, God sweeps you up. He holds you there. The real snag is to stay there and to know how to fall. All those days when you can't hold on any longer, when you tumble, the test is being able to climb up again. That's what I'm looking for. But I wasn't getting up. I wasn't able. So anyway, I'm in the nursing home one Friday afternoon, and Adelita was sitting in the stockroom going through the bottles of cough mixture. And I just sat down on the low ladder and was chatting away with her. She was asking me if I was getting treatment in the hospital, and I find myself lying, flat out lying. Saying, yes, of course, everything's fine, not a bother on me. That's good, she said, because you really need to be looking after yourself. Then she stepped over beside me, pulled up a chair, and started rubbing the inside of my arm. She said that I had to keep the blood flowing. She pushed her fingers into my arm here, and it was like she put her hands down deep in the earth. That's how it felt. I got goosebumps, my blood moving under her fingers. My other hand gripped the side of the ladder, and there was a voice inside me saying, strengthen yourself against this, this is a test, be ready, be ready. But it's the same voice I don't like. I'm looking behind the veil of it, and all I see is this woman. It's a catastrophe. I'm descending, sinking like a hopeless swimmer. And I'm saying, God, don't allow this to happen. Don't let it. She was tapping the inside of my arm with her fingernail, just flicking it. I closed my eyes. Please, don't allow this, please. But it was so pleasant. So, so very pleasant. I wanted to keep my eyes closed and pry them open at the same time. No words for it, brother. I couldn't stand it. I got up and stormed out of the place, stumbled out into the van.
I think I drove all night. I just kept going, following the white lines. I got snared up on bridges, had no idea where I was going. Soon enough, the lights of the city were fading. I figured I was out somewhere way upstate, but it was the island, man, Long Island. I thought I was going west, across some great open land where I'd work everything out, but I wasn't. I was actually heading east along this big highway, and I just kept going, driving and driving, cars zipping by me. I had to keep muttering to myself and lighting matches, smelling the sulphur to keep awake, trying to pray to make 2 + 2 = 5. And then the highway ended, middle of nowhere, it seemed like, and I just followed a smaller road, out through farmland and past these isolated houses, little pinpoints of light. Montauk. I'd never been there before. The dark got thicker, no lights at all. And it turned into this little one-laner. That's what takes you to the end of this country, man. A tiny little potholed road that ends up at a lighthouse. And I thought, this is right. This is where I'll find him. I got out and stepped in among the dunes along the beach. I walked about and screamed at him under the clouds. Not a star shining anywhere, no response. You'd expect a bit of moon at least, something, anything, not even a boat. It was like everything had deserted me. And I could still feel her touch there on the inside of my arm, like it was deep and there was something growing there. And I'm out in the middle of an endless beach with a lighthouse twirling behind me, thinking stupid things, the way you do. I'll move away, I'll give it all up, I'll leave the order, I'll go back to Ireland, find a different poverty. But nothing made sense. The end of the country, man. But there was no revelation. After a while, I gathered myself into that silence, and finally I sat down in the sand and said to myself, well, maybe it will only make me better for him in the long run. I have to fight this, battle it, use it for my own advantage. It's a sign. I resigned myself to it. That which doesn't break you, blah, blah, blah. I was running a fever, but I left the beach, got back in the van, and calmed myself down, and said goodbye to the lighthouse, the water, the east, and said it will be fine. Nothing holy is free. And I drove all the way back to the flat, parked the van, fell into the lift, and closed the door. I actually fell asleep in the lift. Only woke up when it started moving. Found myself staring at the face of some frightened black woman. I scared her. I locked myself in for 2 days, waiting for the bandages to blacken, you know, that sort of thing. Waiting for it to blow over. And I bolted the chain. Can you believe that? I bolted the door shut. So much for the crap I gave you, brother, about the locks. He chuckled a little, and a spray of headlight went across his face from the far side of the boulevard. The girls thought I was dead. They were banging on the door, wanting to use the facilities, and I didn't reply. I just lay there, trying to pray for some sign of gentle mercy. But I kept seeing Adelita in my mind. Eyes closed, eyes open, it didn't matter. Things I shouldn't have been thinking of. Her neck, the back of her neck, her clavicle, the side of her face in a slice of light. There she was, taking me in. And I wanted to scream at her, no, 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 you're just pure lust, and I've made a pact with God to fight lust. Please just let me be, please just go. But she's still standing there, smiling, understanding. And I'd whisper to her again, please go. But I knew it wasn't lust. It was so much more than lust. I was looking for a simple answer, the sort we give to children, you know. And I kept thinking that we were all children once. Maybe I could return. That's what echoed in my mind. Go back to being a child. Sprint along the strand there, up past the tower, run along the wall. I wanted that sort of joy, make it simple again.
I was trying, really trying, to pray, get rid of my lust, return to the good, rediscover that innocence. Circles of circles. And when you go around in circles, brother, the world is very big. But if you plough straight ahead, it's small enough. I wanted to fall along the spokes to the centre of the circle, where there was no movement. I can't explain it, man. It was like I was staring at the ceiling, waiting for the sky. All this banging was still going on outside the door. Then hours of silence. At one time I heard Jaslyn, you know, that voice of hers, like she just swallowed the Bronx man, leaning in against the keyhole and screaming, "Okay, to hell with you, you dumbass cracker!" It's the only time I laughed. If only she knew. "To hell with you, you dumbass cracker. I'll piss somewhere else." Then she actually got the guards in to bash down the door, and they came rushing in, flashing badges, guns drawn. They stop and stare, looking at me, lying on the couch, the Bible over my face. And one cop is saying, "What's going on here, man? What the hell is this? He's not dead. He smells bad, but he's not dead." I'm just lying there, and I swipe the book off my face and cover my eyes with my forearm. And Jazz comes charging in behind them saying, "I gotta go, I gotta go." Then comes Tilly with her pink parasol. Then both of them come out and start shouting, "How come you keep the door locked, Curry? Asshole! That's mean and unusual punishment. That's the honky pox, man." The guards were standing there, open-mouthed. They couldn't believe what was going on. One of them was wrapping a piece of gum tight around his finger. He kept winding it like he wanted to strangle me. I'm sure they were thinking that they had done this for nothing, for a bunch of working girls who just wanted to pee. They were not happy at all. Not at all. They wanted to give me a citation for wasting their time, but they couldn't dream up anything. I said maybe they should give me one for losing my faith, and then they thought I was really off my rocker. One of them said to me, "Look at this shithole. Get a life, man." And it was just so simple the way he said it, the young guard, right in my face. "Get a life, man." He kicked over the flower pot as he went out the door. Tilly and Angie and Jaslyn and the girls threw a not-dead party for me. They even bought me a cake. One candle. I had to blow it out. I was going to take it as a sign, but there were no signs. I went back down the nursing home, and that night I asked Adelita if she'd mind just moving the blood around a little. That's the way I said it. "Move the blood around a little, would you?" She gave me that big, cheerful smile and said that she was busy on her rounds. Maybe she'd get to it later. I sat there, trembling with God, all my sorrows bound up inside. And sure enough, she came back a short while later. It was all very simple. I just stared at the dark of her hair, couldn't look in her eyes. She was rubbing my shoulder and the small of my back and even my calf muscles. I kept hoping maybe somebody would come in the door and find us, make a big stink, but nobody did. And I kissed her, and she kissed me back. I mean, how many men can say they'd rather be nowhere else in the world? That's how I felt, that moment. That I wanted nothing but the here and now and nowhere else. On earth as it is in heaven. That one moment. And then after a few days, I started going to her house. "She's got three kids," you said. "Two. And a husband who got killed down in Guatemala, fighting. For, I don't know, Carlos Serrano Osorio or someone. A fascist of some sort. She hated him, the husband. She got caught up in this marriage young. And still she's got his picture on the bookcase. For the kids to know that he exists, existed. That they had a father. We just sit there, and he's looking out at us. She doesn't talk about him.
He's got this hard stare. I sit in her kitchen, and she cooks a little, and I move the food around on the plate and we chat, and then she rubs my shoulders while her kids are in the other room watching cartoons. She knows I'm in the order,